Okay. So here we go. These are the questions for tonight. And there's a lot in here, so we'll see how we go. Okay. Dear Ajahn, the suttas are awesome. Okay. That's a good start. I like to hear that. That's great. But not in my experience. Okay, how does one protect the happiness one has in the teaching? How does one not destroy one's happiness by thinking one is not good enough? Is it a matter of saying no to such negative self-measuring? Yes, the suttas are awesome, it's true, and very often it's not in our experience. It is kind of beyond where we are at very often. But remember, that's fine, because a lot of the purpose of these suttas is to guide us, is to help us to see the path clearly. So very often it will be like an aspiration towards something greater, right? And this is the wonderful thing about this teaching, is that it kind of promises something wonderful and marvelous. If we were all there already, it wouldn't be any point in being here. So the whole point is to kind of uplift us and to see that, wow, there are things in this world, there are experiences to be had that are so astonishing, so wonderful, so meaningful, so fulfilling, right? It is just such a wonderful thing. And that is the right way of looking at these things. Yes, we are wherever you are at now. That's okay. You don't have to be any better than you are. You just are what you are. You're conditioned into this existence. It's not about being good enough or bad enough. You just have to learn to accept yourself for what you are. This is one of those important things in life, to have a sense of self-acceptance. You know, it's not your fault, right, that you are what you are. This is just how you're born into this life. This is the conditioning that has worked on you over many lifetimes or whatever. And when you accept yourself for what you are, when you become at ease with that, then a lot of the negativity and all the judging, all that stuff, it kind of falls by the wayside. You are okay. There's no problem with you. You are just a product of samsaric existence. It's neither good nor bad. If you have lots of bad thoughts, lots of even bad actions, again, it's nothing to do with you really. It's just the way you have been conditioned. So be satisfied with that. Learn from it. Move in a new direction. Don't judge. And then gradually you will build yourself up and you will be heading towards all this wonderful promise of the Buddhist practice. So please don't destroy the happiness you have by thinking you're not good enough. You are good enough. There's no such thing as not being good enough in Buddhism. There is really no way that you can measure yourself one way or the other. You just are what you are. Okay, good luck. See what happens. Okay, dear Venerable, please would you give a guided meditation on death? Yes, we can probably do that. I think that's can be quite useful as well. I'm not all that used to doing it, but we'll see what happens. Maybe we can try that one of these days when everybody is well settled for the retreat. Okay. Ooh, okay. In the eighth jhana, everything ceases, even consciousness. Does that mean one will fall unconscious and only know it was the eighth jhana after coming out? What are the signs of knowing besides seeing one's consciousness thin and falling unconscious? Okay. So there are really only four jhanas according to the suttas, and then after the jhanas you have the four immaterial attainments, what they are known as. And after the four immaterial attainments there is a state known as sannya vidayita nirodha, which means the cessation of perception and feeling. And these are very profound states, right? And when you get to this, you're basically at the end of the path. You're pretty much an arahant or an anagami. These are very, very profound things. So it's not something you probably have to be too concerned about. But regardless, just to satisfy your curiosity, does it mean that you fall unconscious? It means you become unconscious. Falling unconscious is the kind of thing that when you get somebody gives you a blow over the head, right, and you're out of it. That's falling unconscious. This is more like having absolute clarity, and then from that absolute clarity going into unconsciousness. So it's a bit different from falling unconscious. It is more like you want to be unconscious. You can see that as things cease and things become more and more simple, the more beautiful thing everything is. And then when you come out afterwards, again, you have this incredible clarity, right? It's a very, very powerful clarity of mind. And so then you know what you are seeing is you see that the way that your mind was leaning before you became unconscious, you can see that that was heading towards unconsciousness. And then when you come out afterwards, you can see that you are arising from something. So you can infer from that experience that you were unconscious in between. Because the mind is so powerful, it's so clear, you can see exactly what is going on basically here. So, but it is this is really way down the path, right? This is kind of towards the very end. It's exciting stuff. Sometimes it's nice to talk about it, but it is very profound. Okay, is there a sutta where the Buddha said that dana to him, even though it is fruitful, it is not as fruitful as milking a cow for an hour in metta, and even what is more fruitful is a click of the hand in jhana. As milking a cow for an hour in metta. Well, I don't think there's any sutta which uses exactly that terminology. I've never heard that terminology before. Maybe some kind of sub-commentary somewhere which uses these words. I'm not sure. But yes, there is a sutta, and the only sutta I know which talks about this is called, known as the Velama Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. I think it's the Anguttara 7's number 20, or is it 9? Maybe it's number 9, in the 9's number 20, called the Velama Sutta, and it talks about the different degrees of like making merit or creating good karma. And in that sutta, first of all, it starts off with saying, you know, even if you give it to an animal, it is great merit. I think that's what it said. That's from that sutta. And then it goes up to the highest kind of gift is to give something to the Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, both monks and nuns headed by the Buddha. This is the highest kind of generosity, especially if you give like a dwelling place. A dwelling place is something that can be used down the generations by generation upon generation of monastics, and for that reason it is a very powerful kind of generosity here. But then the Buddha says, better than that is to go for refuge, right? Go for refuge with a heart of confidence and faith that you're doing something powerful and beautiful. That is even more merit, even more good karma, if you like, because your mind is now... Previously you did things that may not have such a massive mental impact, but now you're doing something with the mind itself. Higher than that is to take the 5 precepts, right? So this is a very, very powerful thing to do, especially if you do it again with a heart of faith and confidence that you're doing something powerful and beautiful. The mental aspect is the most important part of these things. And then higher than that, the Buddha says, is to develop the mind in metta, in loving kindness and friendliness, even for a finger snap. Right? So this is the real metta. This is the metta when you really feel enormous, powerful friendliness and kindness to all beings in all directions. Do that for one finger snap. Wow, you're creating enormous good karma for yourself. Right? This is the deep kind of metta that you have. So this is what he says in there. And then he says even more merit, even beyond that. When you have metta of that type, you have an incredible purity of mind, so you are developing the virtue, the sila, to its absolute highest. But beyond that come the insights, and that is if you can see impermanence fully and penetrate to the full understanding of the Buddha's teachings. That's even more merit than developing the metta practice. So that gives you a sense of the hierarchy of good karma, if you like, on the Buddhist path. It's found in a sutta called the Velama Sutta. So if you want to check it out, you can probably just Google on Velama and then you are in business. And you will have it there. Yes, the even more fruitful is a click of the hand in the jhana. So basically, yes, well, jhana and metta are very closely related to each other. So if you have real metta, you're also very close to jhana as well. These things are very, very similar in many ways. Okay. So, next one. Dear Ajahn, some people are so deluded that they may not be aware that they are committing actions of speech that is not skillful. In this case, is the mind still diminished? Is the mind similarly uplifted if the converse is true with metta? Yes, it is. Even though you have no idea that you're committing actions or speech that are bad, that's even worse, right? If you have no idea, because then there is really no way out of those things. You are trapped in bad virtue, in bad morality, and it still obviously has an effect on you. If you do something bad, it will affect your mind, regardless of whether you are aware of it or not. So that is of course very, very unfortunate, but sometimes people are trapped like that. They are trapped in delusion. Delusion is the greatest trap of all, and very hard to come out of it once you enter that sort of state. And it's true, also the reverse is true as well. So even if you don't believe that good actions are good or it doesn't have any effect on you, if you are good and you do the right things, it will still uplift the mind, regardless of what you think or whether you believe in it or not, it will still do that. But it's, of course, it's much better to be aware of these things. If you are aware that the uplifting of the mind happens as a consequence of kindness, you're much more likely to keep on persevering and practicing, because it is the commitment, the long-term commitment to these things, that is so powerful. That is when, over time, it really lifts you up and makes a massive difference. So the hardest thing in Buddhism is not the understanding of the teachings. The understanding of teachings is fairly straightforward, right? Basically, just be kind. That's kind of what it comes down to. But the hard thing is to actually do it, is to commit yourself, to persevere, to change your habits, to start to look at the world and people in a new way. That is the hard part. The commitment is what is difficult. And that commitment can be enhanced by understanding, seeing how these things actually work in your own mind. Okay. Ajahn Brahmali, during meditation, a picture of my late mother, who died last year, appeared. She looked so young and beautiful. It was a picture that I have never, ever seen. Please, can you comment? Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? A picture you have never seen. It's very hard to know what is going on there. It's really, it could be many things. Maybe, one of the things, it may just be a creation of your mind. The mind becomes very creative when it becomes peaceful. So it's probably a good sign that this is happening. It probably means that you are heading in the right direction. Usually you don't get these powerful pictures in the mind unless the mind is getting a little bit peaceful. Unless you are a very, very visual person, then it can happen perhaps even without that. So other people too have told me they have had these pictures in the meditation, all kind of things coming up, and sometimes things that they have never experienced in ordinary life. And often it is just the mind creating stuff, right? The mind being a bit restless or whatever. Okay, so let's create some stuff to have some entertainment for ourselves. And that's fine. Enjoy the entertainment for a while, right? It's like going to the movies. You see these things you've never seen before. Enjoy it a little bit. And then go back to the breath, go back to the metta, go back to whatever meditation object you're doing here. So don't kind of push it aside with aversion, because if you have aversion and negativity, it's going to, again, destroy the fun and the beauty of the meditation. Another possibility, of course, is that perhaps that was your mother coming, right? She has been born in a nice realm, and now she is young and beautiful wherever she is. So maybe she's coming back to you and saying, hello, this is what I look like now. I don't know. You have to decide that for yourself, what you think is more likely to have happened. So you have to kind of investigate that particular experience and see what you think actually may have happened there. But it's quite common that people have these experiences when people die. They have the experience of the person, particularly soon after they have died, that the person comes back to them and says, you know, I'm well, I'm fine. And you see them in a beautiful way, you know, in a much younger appearance and all these kind of things, being happy in whatever destination they are. And very often it's great when that happens, you know. Instead of sorrowing when somebody has passed away, instead of being sad and upset, if you see them like that, happy, good, well looked after in the new existence, well, it's so easy to let go because you know that they are well wherever they are. So these are very useful perceptions. And perhaps this is exactly what is happening to you, a little bit later than usual, after a year. Usually these things happen within a few days, usually, or perhaps a few weeks. But possibly it is the same kind of thing. I don't really know. You have to investigate that for yourself. Okay, so good. Okay. If the eye is the base for seeing and the ear for hearing, what is the base for the mind? Okay, so this is the base for the mind. What is how can we divide up the mind into mind objects and the observing aspect of the mind, right? This is in a sense what you're saying here. Because when we have the eye, it's like the eye is here, and we see stuff out there, the ear is here, we hear stuff. So there is a difference between the two. But when it comes to the mind, it all seems kind of gelled together. It's much more difficult to distinguish these things. And the suttas do actually speak of this. They speak of the mind base and the mind objects, right? There seems to be a distinction there. And the difference, the main aspect, the main difference there is really that consciousness is the awareness. Consciousness is like the most basic aspect of the mind. And then all the things that consciousness perceives, these are like the objects of the mind. So all those objects, like you are thinking something, right, or you're seeing pictures in your mind's eye or whatever, or you're just experiencing bliss, all of those things, they can disappear. And because they can disappear, but you are still conscious, you start to understand that there is a difference between the mind, the awareness, and those objects that the mind actually take. These are not the same thing, because the objects can disappear, whereas consciousness, awareness is still there. That's how you can distinguish between the two. But obviously, in reality, these are just, you know, nice ways of dividing up experience. But in reality, I think the most, really, there is just experience, right? That's really what there is. And then we kind of artificially divide these things up in this way, because it is useful to do that. It's a nice way of trying to understand what is going on. Okay. I have known of many arahants who stay in their room much of the time. What's going on with that? So are these, are here at Dharma Grove, you mean, arahants staying in their rooms? So now you have to look around, who is not here? And then we can we can decide who are the arahants, right? Could it be to do with a lack of will? How do they keep going without any willpower here? Yes, there are different kind of arahants come in all categories, right? There are arahants who are very keen, who are good teachers, and who will, come out and they will give teachings to you. And it's very powerful to be taught by an arahant, of course, because what they say and how they act is pretty much the same thing. They really are the part, you know, it's they walk the talk, as they say. And that is, of course, very powerful when you see that. So it's very useful to have arahants who give teachings. But the Buddha says that even just seeing an arahant in the world is a powerful message. Even if you just see somebody like that, because what you realize when you see somebody who is an arahant, who is very developed, you see somebody who is just who is different from ordinary people. They have this feeling about them which is just so different. You can feel it when you get into their presence. I remember this is a nice story which Ajahn Brahm tells, and the story when he went to see some of the very famous teachers in Thailand. And there was one teacher who was very famous at the time called Ajahn Tate. And Ajahn Tate was very, very highly loved by everybody. He was very gentle and kind, a monk. And he was also loved by the king. So the king built him this enormous hall called the Mandapa. And after his fifth year, Ajahn Brahm was traveling around to meet all of these monks, right? And he went to Ajahn Tate's monastery, and he went to this big hall, because that's where he was expected to meet this Ajahn Tate. And of course, as he approaches this hall, he has all these questions in his mind. Oh, I'm going to ask this great arahant. You don't know whether they're arahants, you're just assuming so, but I'm going to ask this great monk all these questions, right? You have all these questions in your mind. Then he walks into the door of that hall, and when he comes in, he feels it's empty. There's nobody there. There's nobody in the hall. And then he looks around. And then finally, as he looks around, he sees this old man, right, sitting in the corner over there. And the reason he hasn't seen him, because this old man, this old monk, he kind of doesn't exude any self. He doesn't exude any sense of existing almost. It's almost as if he has disappeared. He's become part of the brickwork in the building or whatever, right? He's not there anymore. And these are the kind of feelings you get. Sometimes you think arahants, wow, they're very powerful people. In some ways, of course, they are very powerful. But what is perhaps one of the things that is also astonishing about them is that they don't really, because they don't have that sense of self anymore, in a way, they just disappear, right? So the people who kind of disappear the most, who don't make anything out of themselves, who don't have any need to show off, don't have any need to be anything, these are often the people with the kind of most credential for being arahants. And that's why they will probably stay in their room, right? Why come out? If there's nothing to be done, don't do anything. You just stay in your room. If somebody invites you to give a talk, you give a talk. Otherwise, you just stay there. The arahant doesn't really need or want to go anywhere. And of course, Ajahn Brahm says that when he went to see that monk, and he, kind of this monk, wasn't really there, the sense of peace and the sense of, inspiration in being in the presence of somebody like that, it made him too become completely peaceful at that time. All the questions disappeared, right? No more questions to be asked. And then he thought, oh, I'm feeling a bit silly now. I don't have any questions. What am I doing? What am I doing here? I don't have any questions anymore. But that is kind of the feeling of, some of these beings. So this is probably why sometimes they stay in their rooms, because what's the point, right? Why should I go anywhere? You are perfectly happy and content where you are. There's nowhere to go. There's no future where you're going to find more happiness. This is as happy as anywhere else. So you just stay there until a certain reason arises for you to go somewhere. You have to eat. You have to go to the toilet. You have to give a talk because somebody has invited you or whatever it is. So they still have will. There's no lack of will. But remember that for them there is nowhere to go. There is no future. They don't have any, there's nothing, the happiness they have is right here, right now. They don't have to go anywhere else to find happiness. They still have will because they still have to do things like eat and sleep. So they have to decide, okay, now I'm going to eat. The body needs to eat, right? So the body says, I'm hungry. Okay, so you eat. The body says, go to the toilet, so you go to the toilet. The body says, need to sleep, so you sleep. People ask, give a talk, so you give a talk. You're like this kind of, you're ready to serve, basically, at that stage. Okay. Dear Ajahn, please, if you can, talk about the five contemplations. Not sure of the term. Illness, getting old, dying, what everything dear and pleasing to me will change and become otherwise, and I'm the owner of my karma. Okay. Yes, this is a talk in its own right, to talk about these five contemplations. I'm going to talk about this more later on the retreat, because these are, I think, very important and basic things, part of the practice. So I do actually intend to talk about that. There is one of the suttas talks specifically about the contemplation of illness, old age, and dying. And also, all that is dear and pleasing to me will be changed and become otherwise. And the owner of the karma kind of will come in, I think, as part of that. So I will probably leave that aside for now And we will hopefully get to those things later on here. Okay, dear Ajahn Mali, in this afternoon's session, I noticed a tension between, one, the deterministic notion that all phenomena are conditioned on one another, that there is in fact no self or agent independent from all other phenomena, and that we actually have free will and are responsible for our volitions and actions, implying the existence of a self. Is one or both of these contradictory views the result of ignorance? Would you please kindly comment? Okay, so this is a kind of common problem, right? Because quite true, if everything is conditioned, where is the room for free will, right? This is kind of a standard kind of dilemma. And the point here is that regardless of how it feels like you have free will, right? This is really the point here. It feels like you have free will. And that feeling of free will comes from the perception of a self. Because we have a perception of a self, because we have the self view, the identity view, I exist, it feels like we have free will. And you can't really avoid that feeling of having free will. And regardless of how much you may understand or accept that things ultimately are determined by phenomena, you do things because of conditioning in the past, regardless of how much you accept that point of view, you're still going to feel to you as if you have free will. And this is why we have to take responsibility. This is why we feel bad when we do something, right? Or feel good about doing something, because that freedom of will is something so thoroughly ingrained in us. So don't worry too much about it, right? It is something that you will never really be able to resolve by thinking about it. But what you do, instead of worrying about it, you use that sense of freedom you have inside of you to choose the right things. And if you use that feeling of freedom that you have inside of you to choose the right things, then you will be building up the good qualities, which eventually will allow you the insight to understand this for yourself. So what we're doing here, we're just using the situation, whatever the situation is, we're using it in such a way that we're building up all those good qualities to get yourself into good meditation, into a deep state of samadhi, and then you can have the insight at the other end whether things are fully determined or not. In the meantime, it is a very useful perception to at least accept that things are determined to a very large extent, that we are conditioned to a very large extent. I personally find it very, very useful because it reminds me that the people around me are not really the agents of, you know, that we often think they are. They do things precisely because they are conditioned. And that makes it so easy to forgive other people, right? It makes it so easy to say, okay, it is not really your fault. You have been conditioned in this way. And when I look at my own life, whenever I do something stupid or think something stupid or whatever, I try to look at myself, where is it coming from? Do I really want to do this? And the answer is no. But sometimes I just can't help myself. I still do these stupid things, right? But because I can see, at least to some extent, that I am conditioned into what I am, and I realize if I try to change my habits, it's actually very hard to change those habits. We think about certain people in a certain way, and to change those views often takes a lot of work. And if it is so hard for me to change my habits, if it's so hard for me to change my conditioning, how can I blame other people for being the way they are? Can't really do that, right? So it's a very useful perception in giving rise to wholesome states of mind. And you can be sure that that perception is largely true. We are very conditioned, right? There's no doubt about that. You just have to look a little bit at yourself and look a little bit at other people, and you can see that conditioning is a massive part of who we are. If it is 100% or not, hard to know, perhaps. I say it is 100%, but don't worry so much about that. Wait till you get the insights on your own, and then you can see whether that is the case or not. In the meantime, just use that feeling of freedom of the will to make sure you make progress on the path. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain how the cessation of the cycle of rebirth is not the same as the materialist view of annihilation, and explain how the deathless is different to eternalism? Okay, these are good questions, and these are the things that actually I'm going to talk about to some extent also as part of the explanation of dependent origination, because this is one of those extraordinary things about dependent origination. It actually explains the middle way between, on the one hand, eternalism, and on the other hand, annihilationism. Dependent origination actually is that middle way, and one of the suttas we're going to have a look at actually describes that. But I will describe it briefly now, and the answer, the ending, the cessation of the cycle of rebirth is not the same as the materialist view of annihilation, is that the materialist view of annihilation is that I will cease to exist when I die, right? The sense of I, the sense of an entity, of you being somebody, that will be destroyed when you die. Because almost everybody has that view, to some extent, except if you're an arahant or an arya or whatever, it feels like you will be annihilated, you will actually come to an end. The difference, so the cessation from the cycle of existence is that when you see through that delusion, and you see that there is nothing there, there's nothing inside of you, which ever was the real you anyway, then when you die, the ending of samsara, it is just the ending of dukkha. That's all it is, because the five khandhas, as we saw before, they are dukkha. So when samsara ends, it is just dukkha coming to an end. That's all it is. Right? So that is the difference. One thing is dukkha, suffering ceasing, and the other one is the annihilation of something you take to be permanent there. Right? So dukkha ceasing is fine, right? If it's all it happens is dukkha ceasing, wonderful, no problem. But if you annihilate something which is intrinsically is you as a person, then there is a problem there. So this is the difference between the two. And how is the deathless is different from eternalism? Well, the difference is that the deathless, or I don't really like the term deathless so much, the freedom from death might be a better term. The difference is that eternalism is something moving on forever, right? Yourself somehow has been released from all the other phenomena of existence. You go to some nice place and you hang out there forever after. That's eternalism. The deathless is something very different. The deathless, or the freedom from death, is the ending of suffering. It doesn't say anything about what happens afterwards. What happens afterwards is irrelevant. You're free from suffering. That's what matters. As long as you keep on going, as long as you keep on hanging out, as long as there is some kind of eternalism, there is normally suffering. The suffering is part of that. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, I am 67 years old. It may be good for me to die now while I have yet to suffer the body rotting away. As I have been a good person, it is likely that I will be reborn in a good destination. Is this craving? I think the question is at the bottom here. okay, well, it is not recommended to kind of to say, yeah, you know, okay, I made all this good karma, let me just kind of kill myself because then I will get reborn in a good destination. You have to be careful about those kind of things, and indeed, you're quite right, it probably is just craving, right? Oh, I want some happiness, I don't want to have all this suffering in my life, so let's just go to that good destination straight away. I don't think that's a very skillful thing to do. It is craving, and you are probably likely to cause all sorts of unforeseen consequences by killing yourself in this way. There is a simile about this somewhere, and there's a simile, someone asks precisely this question, I think, to one of the monks. This is Kumara Kassapa. Which sutta is this again? This is the sutta in Digha Nikaya, Payasi Sutta, that's right, Digha Nikaya number 23, I think it is, a simile, which is very similar to this. And This simile is of this Brahmin, and this Brahmin man, he has a wife, right? And this man and his wife gets pregnant, and there's something, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but he says something about to this woman that, well, if this is a boy that you get, then it is great, but if it is a girl, then I don't want to have anything more to do with you, or something to that effect. So this is kind of, you know, having a boy was kind of the way in those days. And so this woman, she is kind of desperate to find out whether it's a boy or a girl, because one thing will lead to disaster, but the other way will lead to happiness for her, right? So what she does, she decides to cut open her belly to find out whether this child is a boy or a girl. And of course, that is the wrong way to find out whether it is a boy or a girl. And of course, she dies as a consequence. And that is exactly what this Kumara Kassapa says. That's the same thing that you do. If you want to find out whether you're going to go to heaven by killing yourself, it's exactly the same thing as this woman cutting open her belly to find out the gender of the child. So it seems it is not recommended, right? It is something probably not a very good idea, is kind of the message from that sutta. So much better to do is to 67 years old. Isn't that ancient, right? You still may have many good years ahead of you. Maybe there will be some suffering towards the very end. You just don't know. Maybe there won't be any suffering. Maybe you just die quickly. Who knows what's going to happen? You can have many, many years ahead of you, coming to Jhana Grove, doing meditation retreats, doing dana, doing kindness, boosting your store of merit, right? Much more. So you go to even better destination when eventually you pass away. Don't miss the opportunity. You have no idea whether there will be any Dhamma where you're heading in your future life. Now you have the chance. Don't waste it. And if you use that time skillfully, then you will actually be much better for you than if you kill yourself and then you end up like that poor Brahmin lady who died as a consequence of her own silliness. So this is really, I think, the best way of looking at it. Of course, if you really one day become so sick and so ill that life really is, doesn't have any more quality, and you think that is a good time to do euthanasia, whatever, that's a different story. But don't do it while you still have the opportunity to live healthy and live well. I don't think that is a good idea at all. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, in the Sutta Nipata Sutta, Sanyutta Nikaya 1240, that we looked at before today, called Volition, the Buddha mentions whatever one has a tendency towards. Are these the tendencies we have brought with us from previous births, the asavas? The tendencies that you have are a mixture of all kind of things, right? A mixture of the things that you bring with you from previous lives, and also the way you have developed your mind in this life. All of these things come together. And as they come together, your mind, the tendency of the mind are always changing as well. As you are developing yourself, those tendencies change, and your tendency becomes perhaps more towards meditation practice, becomes more towards higher states of mind. So they're always changing, always moving in new directions. For many people, if you don't have a spiritual practice and you're just indulging in ordinary life, in ordinary sensual experiences, those tendencies can remain very stagnant and remain very much the same over long periods of time. But for somebody who is sincere about the spiritual practice, doing what is right, doing what is good, the chances are the tendency will change. You'll be lifting yourself up, achieving a higher state of consciousness, a lighter mind, a more beautiful state of mind. And that is part of the underlying tendencies changing as a consequence. The asavas are... the asavas are just a way of looking at the defilements, right? So the asavas are also changing. There is the kam asava, which is the asava means like defilement or corruption of the mind. That's one way of translating it. The kam asava is the asava of sensuality. So it is the mind having the sensuality. And of course, as you practice, that the degree of sensuality that you have will change as a consequence. If your meditations go well, that asava will start to die down and become less. So the asavas also vary, right? The intensity varies over time. But the full ending of these asavas, there's also the bhavasava, the corruption of existence or of desire to exist that we were looking at before today, and the avijjasava, the corruption of ignorance or delusion, if you like. So these are different ways of looking at the path, different ways of looking at the defilements. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. Dear Ajahn, why is nama translated as name? A form or anything could be name. Okay, so we're going to talk tomorrow about nama, and I'm going to explain there what it actually means. But briefly, nama in the sutta, name, you're right, it is a strange word to use, but it actually is related to the Pali word nama, right? Nama and name is actually the same word. Remember, we're dealing with the Indo-European languages here. So English language is actually related to ancient Sanskrit and Pali. These are all the same, comes from the same source. And that's why the word nama, it almost sounds like name. And there's a reason for that. But really what it means the mental aspect of existence. So that's why it's called name and form. Form is the material aspect of existence. Nama is the mental aspect, but not except for consciousness. So feelings, the will, right? The way we perceive the world, all of that is what is called nama here. The reason it's called name is because these are the aspects through which we name things. When I say ceiling, right? When I say floor, I'm using the aspects of the mind to make up these names. That's why it is called, one reason why it is called name, is the naming ability of the mind. When we perceive the world, we perceive things, it is because we have named them in a certain way. Color brown, right, and all of these things, these are names created by the mind. And that is the connection between name and the mental aspects of the mind. These things go together. Very important part of the mind is precisely this naming activity. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to make sense of anything here. Okay, so I hope that makes sense, and we're going to look more at that tomorrow here. Okay, dear Venerable, the sutta that the Lord Buddha talked about, patience, is the kakachuppama vadaya with metta. You mean the kakach? Do you mean the simile of the soul, is that the one you mean? Manikaya 21, Kakachupama Sutta, Kakachupama Uvada Sutta, that's probably the one you mean. Okay, so that's Manikaya 21, and that is a very famous simile of the soul, and that is the simile where the Buddha says, just like if somebody comes along, they take a two-handled saw, like these old saws, right, really rough, rusty saws, big ones with a saw blade, a handle in either end, and they take that and they cut you apart, limb by limb. And even as these bandits, these scallywags, these scoundrels cut you apart, limb by limb, you still have metta towards those people. Right? That's what the Buddha says. Whoa. It's beautiful, right? It's actually very fascinating. You may think, it's impossible. You can't do that. You can't have metta and friendliness and kindness to somebody who's cutting you apart limb by limb. Impossible. But no, it isn't impossible. It is possible. And this is obviously why the Buddha uses this simile. And it just sets the bar really, really high. And it shows you how far it is possible to go on this path. It shows you a kind of, wow, this is possible to do. Amazing. Let's see if we can get there. And again, it is possible by understanding that, you know, they are fools, right? They're completely stupid for cutting you apart limb by limb. They don't know what they're doing here. They may be hurting you a little bit, but the hurt you're having is just, okay, you're hurting now when you're being cut apart, but then soon you will be dead and it will be gone. But they have to live with that action for lifetimes afterwards. They are fools. So your perception is changed. You have compassion. You have kindness for them, despite their stupid acts. So that is patience. You're quite right. That is kind of patience. in the highest degree, right? When you are patient with people who are doing this kind of action towards you. And that sutta is actually a very beautiful sutta, and I have read it out on earlier retreats. I don't think it is part of the suttas this year, but it is very nice and very worthwhile reading. Okay. In Sanyutta Nikaya 12.40, the same sutta we're talking about just a minute ago, the Lord Buddha teaches that intent leads to a wholeness of suffering. But intent can be both good and bad. How do you think we should do? Should we not do both good and bad? What is the middle path to us? Wholeness of suffering. Is that what it says? Let me have a look and see what it says. I don't think that those were the exact words, but let's see what the exact words are here, so we get this right. Okay, so what you mean? Okay, so what you're talking about is the whole mass of suffering, right? Yeah, that's what you are probably saying there. The whole mass of suffering. Yes. Well, the point is that as long as you stay in samsara, right, as long as you are part of the round of rebirth, remember, you are going up and down. Now you get reborn in a bad destination, now in a good destination. And in the long run, you get reborn everywhere. Yes, it is true that in this life you may be a Buddhist, in this life you may be doing all the right things, and as a consequence you will have a happy rebirth in your next one, and maybe in the one after that, maybe in the next 100 lives you maybe have a happy rebirth, but eventually you're going to go down again, right? And in the long run, and when the Buddha talks about the long run, he really means the long run, right? Eon after eon, universe after universe. The really, really long run. In the long run, you're going to go up and down, through various things. And that is when you accumulate this whole mass of suffering as a consequence. Imagine that you get reborn in a heavenly realm 100 times in a row. But at the end of those 100 times, you have exhausted all your good karma. And you have somehow, you've come under the influence of bad, somebody bad, right? You start doing bad things. And as a consequence, you get reborn in a place of suffering. At that point, that is the present reality. It doesn't matter anymore if you've been reborn in the heavenly realm 100 times. At that point, you will suffer. At that point, all of that is kind of irrelevant, whether you have been in the heavenly realm for so long. So you have to think long term. Next life, great. But what about the life after that? Eventually, you will have to suffer. So this is what this means. It doesn't mean that good and bad intent don't matter. It matters enormously. Please have good intent, because the good intent is not only does it make you reborn in a good place, it also carries you forward on the path. Right? Win-win situation. Double kind of goodness that comes out of that. So please do as much good as you can. Don't think that good, doing good is bad. It is not like finding the middle way between good and bad. It's actually to do good is great. It is a wonderful thing. And then you're heading in the right direction. Okay. Okay, good. Dear Venerable Bhante, thank you for the wonderful Dhamma talks. They are very inspiring. Okay, great. I am wondering about the phrase, I do to not intend and not to plan. How do we do this in our lives if we have built up a habit of intention and plans over long duration? How can we undo this habit and seize our perpetual intentions and plans with metta? Yes, this is something that somebody asked me today as well, before at the interview time. And the purpose of this sutta is not so much to tell you that you should stop intending and planning, because really that is impossible. You cannot stop intending and planning. The purpose of this sutta is to show you the mechanism by which rebirth takes place, by which this samsara is sustained, by how you keep on going around from life to life, now happy, now suffering, etc. This is really the purpose. So it's not so much teaching you what to do, it's teaching you basically how things work. So the answer is don't try to to really stop intending and planning. Rather make sure that you intend and plan in the right way. You intend and plan in a way that leads to your uplift rather than dragging you down. And then when it comes to meditation practice, that is the time not to intend and plan at all, right? The rest of our lives we intend and plan. When it comes to meditation practice, that is the time to calm the mind down, not allow the intention and planning to go on. You just sit there. You just have present moment awareness. When you are just aware of what's happening, you're just aware of what's going on, you're not really intending and planning anything. The will has kind of died down. And that is one of the beautiful results of meditation practice. You can feel that it's very peaceful, it's very beautiful when the will is dying away and passing and kind of disappearing. It's actually a very nice state of mind. So enjoy that. Understand that actually the will is something unpleasant, and then you're doing the right thing here. So yeah, don't worry too much about that. Don't try to stop planning. I don't think that is the right approach. Rather focus, if you want to focus on the practice, much better to focus on the Noble Eightfold Path. That is what shows you what you need to do. And as a consequence of that doing, this intention and planning will eventually die down all by itself without you willing it or wanting it or anything at all. Okay, health, Ajahn. Okay, I thought I was doing okay. Thank you for your wise teachings, Sadhu. So full of clarity here. Okay, great. That's wonderful. So presumably that is someone is doing well and somebody is happy. So that's always good. I thought at the beginning I thought you were going to ask for help, but that was obviously not the case. Okay, excellent. Okay. Dear Ajahn, about a month ago, I heard Ajahn Brahm mention something on the Visuddhimagga in one of his Friday night talks. It was about the path without a traveler. Can you please explain this? Yeah, so I think there's a verse in the Visuddhimagga which says, there is a path, but no traveler upon it can be found. Right? So there is a path. The path is being practiced, but there's no traveler upon the path. A very famous verse from the Visuddhimagga. And the idea, of course, is very simply that the path is there, but if there is no real self, if there's no inherent identity to a human being, no thing, lasting thing which is part of us, then there is nobody actually doing the traveling. The path is just something that happens, right? It's like we are the path. The way our mind is changing, the way our experience is changing all the time, that itself is the path. That is the path developing. So there is a path, but nobody actually travels the path. It's just the development of the mind and the development of our personalities and habits. That is all that is happening here. Yeah? So if you want to ask that again, please do so, if it wasn't clear enough. Dear Ajahn, I'm going a little bit fast because there are so many questions. Just to get them all done, it's always nice to get them done every day, so we can continue afresh tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain free of debt before somebody enter the monastic community? Okay, long time ago, I was in another country, and I had some small debts for a few people which I couldn't pay back. I don't know where those people are now, and I've totally lost contact with them. Okay, ooh. Okay, so, well, I think, in that case, I think you are fine, because there is no way that you can repay that debt, right? You have tried your best. And you have done what you can to repay your debts. So if you have done your best and tried what you can, then there is no real problem. Nobody's going to say that you can't ordain as a monastic because of that. So free of debts really just means that you are, you know, you haven't got kind of creditors over your head chasing you, right? Saying, pay back. No, I'm going to ordain. I'm going to get away from my debts by ordaining. Ha ha, evil, right? If that's what you think, then you have a problem. And that's what people actually did at the time of the Buddha. They had all these debts. They thought, oh, if I ordain, nobody can touch me. Because in those days, if you were a samana, an ascetic, a monastic, it meant that you were kind of untouchable. You were outside of society. Or people who were soldiers, right? They were fed up of being soldiers. They were in the king's service. So they entered the Sangha. Or they were slaves. They would enter the Sangha. And then when people came, they said, well, where is my slave? They had entered the Sangha. Okay, you can't touch them anymore. They become they are kind of beyond the thing. Or you had some kind of contract with the government that you're supposed to do, but you don't want to do it, so you enter the Sangha. You want a good doctor, you enter the Sangha. You want to live, right? In those days, life was much harder than it is now. You wanted an easy way to live. You enter the Sangha. Oh, people would just give me food, right? I would just sit back and eat and just enjoy life. That was how people thought in those days. It's an easy life. The Sangha had some very good doctors, the famous Dr. Jivaka, who existed at the time, who looked after the Buddha, looked after all the great arahants. And people said, oh, I'm getting really sick. I can't afford a doctor. Enter the Sangha. Right? That's how it was, because the Sangha was, in many ways, was a kind of that sort of freedom from refuge and had a lot of benefits that ordinary people could not afford. But you are doing the right thing. You have no problems. If you can't find the people, then there is no issue there. You have done your best, and that's all you can really do. So that's good, isn't it? Somebody who wants to become a monk or a nun. That's really, really cool. So great. Well done. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn B, that's what it says here. Was it easier to gain entry into the jhanas during the Buddha's time because of so much less sensual pleasures? Being a grandma, I find it very difficult to be wise and get out of samsaric cycle. Oh dear, how many more rebirths? Okay. Was it easier because of less sensual pleasures? I think, of course, in the modern world, there's a lot of distractions, a lot of very easy to kind of get caught up in things. You know, often things are very easily available, all kinds of sensual pleasures, especially if you have a bit of money, etc., which many people have these days in the West. And that can, of course, make it more difficult. So it means that you have to be a bit wiser about the danger in those things, and you have to have more understanding of the happiness of meditation. So there may be some truth to that. At the Buddha's time, perhaps the sensual pleasures weren't as great. But still, you know, at that time as well, people were messing around, people were doing all kinds of stuff, you know, just like people always have done. So I don't think the difference perhaps is all that much. It isn't kind of, you know, a massive difference. The pleasures that we have are roughly the same. In those days they had nice food or bad food. They had, you know, they were obviously married and had relationships and all that kind of stuff. I don't think the difference is all that enormous. Really it is a matter of getting a slightly different perspective. And hopefully you will get that slightly different perspective just by enjoying your meditation a little bit, to see that when you extract yourself from those sensual pleasures, actually there is a certain happiness to be had, which is more refined and actually better and more stable, right, than the external happinesses. One of the great problems of sensual pleasures in the world and all the sensual objects is that they are so unreliable, they're so unfaithful, because they are outside of you. You cannot control the world outside. You don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know when your partner is going to leave you or die or get sick. You don't know when your house is going to burn down. You don't know when you're going to lose all your money on the stock market or whatever it is. These things are so unreliable. It may not look like any of these things are going to happen to you, but suddenly something happens out of the blue, right? This is what happens all the time. It is so really very unreliable, very impermanent. And it's like you're trying to stand on the floor and somebody's trying to pull out the carpet from under your legs all the time. There's nowhere to stand. As soon as you attach to something, that attachment, you're asking for suffering because somebody's going to come and pull the rug out and say, sorry, you attached to something that actually was impermanent and now you're going to suffer as a consequence. And this is the reality. That external world is inherently unreliable. Whereas the internal world that we develop for ourselves by using practice in the path wisely is much more reliable, because it is something that at the very least we have a little bit of control over, because it relates only to ourselves. So in a way, this practice of Buddhism makes you more independent. It makes you independent of all those external, unreliable things, right? And that is one of the great benefits of this path. So you have to contemplate these things. We had the question before about, somebody asked about the five recollections of contemplation, one of which is to remember that everything beloved and pleasing will be changed and become otherwise. That is exactly that kind of contemplation, right? Everything beloved and pleasing, absolutely everything, will change and become otherwise. And there is no certainty when it's going to happen. It can happen at any time. And once that starts to sink in, once the anicca, the reality of this, the fact that the carpet is always being pulled out from under your feet, there's nowhere to stand. There's nowhere to really stand. As soon as you're attached to something, you're saying, let me suffer. Right? That's basically what it means. As soon as you're attached, you're saying suffering is going to happen next. That is the way it has to be. And once that starts to become clear, of course, the path of a spiritual practice, of establishing a sense of security and happiness inside of yourself, becomes so important and so fulfilling, because then you are free of the problems, at least to some extent, that the external world would otherwise give you. So just think about these things in this way. Don't force things. Don't force yourself to do anything. But just try to reflect on these things a little bit and see what that does to you. And if you reflect on these things in the right way, it will lead you in the right direction. That's presumably why you're here, right? Well done, you're already here. That's pretty good already. So you already have a lot of wisdom to even be here, to even be part of this kind of retreat. The majority of people in the world think that this is torture to come on a meditation retreat. At least you have understood there's something to be gained from this, right? It's not just for torture. Actually, there's something very good to be had here. Oh dear, how many more rebirths? You don't know. Maybe there isn't that many more rebirths. Maybe suddenly the wisdom will start to arise inside of you, right? You just don't know. So just keep on doing the right thing, and the number of rebirths may be reduced dramatically. Okay. One last question. Dear Ajahn, can you please let people know that there are electric room heaters, not talking about the water heater, that are stored inside each accommodation for them to use. There are unused heaters right now, which suggests some of us may not be aware. Okay, so there is electric heaters that you can take into your room, right? So if you are cold or whatever, please turn on the heater. That's why they are there. There should be one heater for each room, at least, so that you don't have to suffer. It gets quite cold these days. This is the winter time. I thought when I left Norway I'd come to nice and warm Australia, but that was a mistake, right? After a while, you start to feel cold here as well. So please use those heaters. That's what they're there for. Please don't suffer. We're supposed to be comfortable while we're here, and at ease and relaxed, and have a sense of care and kindness to ourselves. So please care for yourself. If you care for yourself, then you are likely to find so much more pleasure and happiness also in your meditation practice. Okay, so that is it for tonight. So have a nice night as usual. Enjoy everything. And then let's end off by doing the Arahang Sammasambuddho.